firmly convinced that the bill was wrong, and that the present method of choosing an attorney general is an appropriate one, and far better than what would develop should you elect one. And in a sense, I suppose it might be a person might look at it as this: it's kind of a lesser of two evils. Granted, there is some conflict between the governor and the attorney general, as perceived by the people of the state. The Anchorage Times has recently taken this issue up and has frequently said that the attorney general should be elected. And I think it's principally because the present attorney general has a different philosophy than the Anchorage Times. And a number of times the attorney general has given an opinion, and it's completely contrary to the philosophy of the people.
Can I interrupt on that? The concept of attorney general is completely misunderstood. Completely. The name isn't even mentioned in the Constitution. When a lawyer went broke when I was a kid, and everybody felt sorry for him, they said, well, let's get him to be attorney general because it'll give him a salary and he can make a living. And that's just about what the job is. It's a totally useless job. The attorney general is the governor's legal advisor, period. That's exactly what he is. And you're supposed to disagree with the attorney general. But I think the error is in making one of these political appointees, and that's exactly what he is, putting him in charge of the administration of justice, the prosecution of the crimes, for example. That should be a separate function. It shouldn't have anything to do with the damn fool attorney general, really. And an attorney general's opinion doesn't have any force and effect. There's nothing to it. It's just some guy's opinion as to what should be done. And he's usually wrong.
Except when I was there.
John was a good attorney general, and I'll tell you exactly why he was picked. He was picked because he had an affinity for Indians. He liked natives, and he understood them. And that's one reason he was the attorney general of Alaska, because if we put some guy in there that wasn't sympathetic to Indians, nothing but disaster would have followed. And being an intelligent man, he had a wholesome and healthy respect for Indians as human beings, and that was great. But the job is just completely blown out of proportion.
John, I think to a certain degree you're right. But I think what the present system does that would be, in my view, somewhat dangerous if it was changed, is that, and John Havelock mentioned it, it adds a sense of stability to prosecution and also the interpretation of our laws.
What the hell does an attorney general know about the prosecution of crimes? He's usually picked because he's a scholarly guy, he's got a good head on him, he's intellectual. But that doesn't mean he knows anything about prosecuting criminal cases. Usually that's the last thing he knows.
But
I wouldn't give him that responsibility.
The attorney general wouldn't necessarily change that. In fact, in a sense,
I bitterly oppose an elected attorney general, but it should be just an appointed job, but it should be divorced from this miserable appellation of attorney general, which means nothing.
So we kind of mix it up after...
I just wanted to make that point.
Okay, as I had indicated, the Constitution envisioned the governor as a strong executive, as the chief executive, and over the last couple of years some of that authority has been eroding. In the area of the governor dealing with employees, and I, as commissioner of the Department of Administration, in charge of the merit system, as has been mentioned here just earlier. And many times people fear that the government is being run from the bottom up, meaning that your governor and your commissioners have very little influence over the direction of government. And in certain areas, that's very true. But I think basically the employees recognize that the governor and the commissioners and the heads of the various divisions are the leaders, are the executives of those areas. And you do get your direction from the top. However, there are problems. The merit system in the Constitution was designed to try to give the most qualified employees the jobs. However, it's very difficult to quantify who is qualified and who is not. We've made an attempt, there are problems with it, and I'm not sure they'll ever be resolved. In the merit system, the executive branch or the chief executive do lose a lot of their authority. They lose a lot of their authority in determining who is going to do a job and who is not, because there are certain parameters they have to work within, and it does cause problems. Another area that is eroding the decision-making capabilities of the executive branch is the collective bargaining law. As most of you know, collective bargaining in the state of Alaska is a way of life. It has been for several years. It had a rather stormy beginning, and it may still be perceived as such. In our contracts with the employees, they continually want to negotiate for what we determine are management rights, you know, determining working conditions, determining how something gets done, and in what manner. Naturally, management always resists this, but in the negotiating process, it's an excellent opportunity for these things to get picked at. As an example, in one of our collective bargaining agreements, in a past one, I should say, there was a provision that would preclude the executive branch from contracting work out to the private sector that has been traditionally done by state employees. We have modified that, but nevertheless, there's a foothold there, and I anticipate that becoming a larger issue in the years to come. The other thing that was mentioned earlier is Section 26 boards. We presently have several of them, Fish and Game, and Department of Education. John Havelock indicated that Section 26 commissioner, his knees rattled just as much as a commissioner that's appointed by the governor. And that's probably true, but there is one substantial difference in that a commissioner such as myself, appointed by the governor has the choice to choose a person that has a philosophy such as his. A Section 26 commissioner, the governor does not have that opportunity. And I submit that a commissioner of Fish and Game who wants to allow hunters to shoot cow moose is eventually going to get his way with the governor, in spite of the governor's either adamant, not necessarily adamant, but philosophical opposition to it. In the case of cow moose, it's rather moot because the legislature has taken it. But I think that the problem with Section 26 commissioners is that the governor does not have the opportunity to choose somebody of his philosophy, and consequently, the philosophy of that department will frequently deviate from that of the governor. Probably the greatest conflict or the greatest erosion of powers of the executive have been effectuated by the legislature, and it's partially because the legislature has matured, I think, substantially in the last couple of years, partially under the leadership of Senate President Chauncey Croft and Speaker Mike Bradner.
With all respect to Chauncey, I don't think the word mature is appropriate.
I was going to agree with Andy there on that.
So, but, you know, part of it is a realization, I think, on the part of a number of legislators that they have not had adequate staff in the past to deal with the problems. And recently, they have taken the bull by the horns, and they have hired that staff. And naturally, their staff reflects the philosophies of the people that hire them. But several areas of substantial conflict that we've had recently between the executive branch and the legislature has had to do with money and how that money is spent. Recently, the legislature has added to the budget bill, which is an appropriation bill, some rather astringent parameters that the governor was required to follow should he adopt the budget bill. As an example, in appropriating the money, the general fund budget, they put the restrictions that the governor could not create any new positions without approval of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. They also put in their provisions that the governor could not accept any what we call custodial funds from the federal government or anybody else without approval, could not expend them without approval of the Budget and Audit Committee. as a member of the executive branch, a commissioner, as a commissioner administration, I took exception to that, and I viewed it as an encroachment upon the executive branch. It's traditionally an executive function. The governor wants to create a position to do something, the governor should have that ability. I can appreciate at times the legislator's concern over the proliferation of new personnel, but I think that is a responsibility of the governor, not necessarily the legislature. Also, recently we have had a conflict between the legislature and the executive branch over bond bills. As you know, the governor sent down a recommendation or an ultimatum to the legislature that he would not accept general obligation authorizations in excess of $240 million. The legislature subsequently sent to him authorizations totaling close to $280 million, something like $40 million over what the governor had determined was an appropriate level. The governor subsequently line item vetoed some of those appropriations in the bond bill, and the matter is presently before the courts. I believe the Superior Court has recently ruled in favor of the legislature, and the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska will ultimately decide that fate.
The governor was just as wrong in doing that as the legislature was in demanding that they confirm the appointment of division head.
Yeah, that was the next subject. Although I don't know the governor was wrong in doing that.
Hell, he wasn't. He had no right to line item.
The Supreme Court of Alaska will make that determination. The legislature also recently required that the directors and deputy commissioners go through the confirmation process that the commissioners do. And the governor balked at that, mainly at the suggestion of his attorney general.
A good Democrat would have told him that, too.
Well,
he was right.
He was ultimately
none of their damn business.
He was ultimately proved right by the courts. And I think that issue alone probably more typifies the conflict between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Many legislators had become somewhat frustrated by their inability to effectuate their ideas and philosophies through the executive branch. So they thought that if they had some confirmation powers over these people, they would have a better handle on the individuals and the philosophies, I suppose, of the individuals that were appointed to them. They would also have the opportunity to discuss their problems with these individuals at the confirmation hearing. Well, the court system disagreed with them and held that the responsibility for these individuals is with the executive branch, not with the legislative branch. I think, in summary, as I indicated, the Constitution did set up a very strong executive, and recently there has been some erosion of the executive's powers. However, I think the people of the state of Alaska are very happy with a strong executive, and maybe it's because we're a relatively small state, and we like to know, as Harry Truman once said, that the buck stops at one place. And I think the governor of the state of Alaska needs to assume that responsibility, and the people need to know that there is one individual they can go to resolve a problem. And I think it's there, and I think the people know it. And I think that in the state of Alaska, we will continue to have a strong executive, regardless of some erosion of powers. It'll probably go one way and then back the other, but I think, as I am happy about it, I think basically the people are happy.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
May I suggest a break for about 5 minutes so that I can light my cigarette and someone might want some coffee?
Fine.
Thank you. I'm going to have to leave at 11:15, so whatever happens then, I don't want you to think that it's because somebody said something that I'm walking out of the room. There are a couple comments that I'd like to make in terms of what I've seen with regard to the executive.
article of the Constitution and then respond to some of the comments that have already been made. As far as the strong executive concept is concerned, I think people are generally satisfied with it. There have been a lot of amendments to the Constitution in the past 20 years. There have been none to the executive article, with the exception of changing the name of the Secretary of State to the Lieutenant Governor, which, while it probably isn't particularly significant, may, in one respect, have been a mistake. The strong executive concept, though, does have some ramifications that I think are becoming obvious that might not have been anticipated, but maybe they were, and it hasn't really been discussed yet, but I think it's important to at least comment on them in that regard. I think it's significant that of the four elections where the incumbent governor has sought re-election under this Constitution, he's only been elected or re-elected one time in 1962. In 66, the incumbent governor was defeated. In 70, even though he hadn't been elected in 66, the incumbent governor was defeated. The same was true in 1974. And I think that has to do, to some extent, with the strong executive concept. I think that really, in quite a few different ways, what the Constitution set up was a system of naked power. And that the result of that has been that, in some terms, there's really no place for the governor of Alaska to hide in terms of some responsibility. And I think there have been some adjustments that all governors have made to that political fact. But the fact remains that as far as Alaska is concerned, if there's any dissatisfaction with the way the executive branch of government performs, all of that political dissatisfaction focuses on the governor, because, as has been pointed out, he is the chief executive officer. And I think that there have been some ramifications of that. Basically, what we've seen at the presidential level as well, and that is there has developed a sort of palace guard around the governor that often shields the governor, and that is one of the purposes some of the time of the governor's staff. Shields him not only to some extent from the public, but with all due respect to the people in this room, some of the time from commissioners as well. And I'm not saying that necessitates any change in the Constitution, but I do think that's a fact that ought to be discussed in that way. As far as the relationship between the executive and other branches, I think with regard to the judicial branch, for the most part, it's been uneventful. There was a budget fight between the court system and the administration. Chief Justice Boney became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court over the review by the executive of the budget. But other than that, the relations have been somewhat peaceful. With regard to the university, which I consider more like the fourth branch of government than any other particular thing, there has been some increasing conflict between the executive and the university. It's also been true between the university and the legislature. But that role really isn't clearly defined in the Constitution. And I think that's an area where it's likely in the future there will be increasing conflict. As far as the legislature is concerned, I think that the conflict has been even greater than Andy has suggested. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the elimination of the discord and the disputes and the conflict within the executive by the strong executive concept has meant that type of discussion of issues, that type of discord, has been shifted to a fight between the executive and the legislative branches, instead of occurring often within the legislature, within the executive branch itself. And certainly it's covered a wide range of issues. And I think that conflict is likely to continue regardless of the particular political makeup of the legislature or the party affiliation of the governor. It will wax and wane to some extent, but I think the assertion of legislative prerogative is a result of the strong executive concept, and So I would expect even more of it. But look at where it's occurred so far. With regard to appropriation, not just what Andy has mentioned, even though that's significant, but it occurred in January of this year where the legislature sued the governor over the Alcantara Youth Center in Palmer and actually forced the governor to spend money that the governor had requested in his budget and had approved, but decided 6 months later he no longer wanted to spend. That resulted in the judicial branch refereeing that fight between the executive and the legislature, and the executive agreeing to spend the money as it requested. With the recent fight with regard to the conversion of the Columbia, where the executive took the opposite approach from the Alcantara case and wanted to spend money that hadn't been appropriated instead of trying to not spend money that had been appropriated, and that wound up in court as well, that apparently has been somewhat settled. The Budget and Audit Committee, which I think Andy has covered, the Pipeline Impact Committee suit was the forerunner of that. That actually occurred in 1974, in which the legislature attempted to preserve to itself control over the way that appropriations were spent. That suit resulted in a court saying that the legislature did not have that power, and that suit, I think, that decision by the court was entirely correct. With regard to confirmation, there have been two disputes between the legislature and the executive that have come up within the past 2 years. One, Commissioner Warwick is very familiar with, but didn't mention, and I think it should be reiterated again, that the suit filed by the legislature contesting his appointment to that office had absolutely nothing to do with him as a person. Regard to Attorney General Havelock's remark, and Mr. Hellenthal, is about whether the legislature has failed to confirm people. We have done that. We have set up even a procedure this year requiring hearings. That was a portion of the bill that was not attacked, but was in the legislation that was attacked, requiring confirmation of deputy commissioners. The bill does require legislative hearings with regard to appointments, and that is something that we did start in 75. But the suit over Commissioner Ward's appointment had absolutely nothing to do with his qualifications, and I think almost every legislator would agree with that. With regard to executive orders, happened again twice this year, once with regard to archives, where an executive order was set aside with regard to the Department of Transportation, and also with regard to the Department of Economic Development, which that was originally should have been abolished by executive order, and turned out in 1975 instead that was done by statute. The question of the Department of Transportation is still pending. With regard to management of resources, the governor's authority in that regard, there's likely to be litigation over the constitutionality of the Royalty Oil and Gas Advisory Board. There is a proposition on the ballot at this time, Proposition Number 3, we voted on in November, clearly defining the authority between the legislature and the executive with regard to disposal of interest in land. With regard to reapportionment, and I personally think that our reapportionment system it may have its faults, it's probably better than any other system, but there have been at least two cases involving governor's authority there, Wade versus Nolan and Egan versus Hammond. And then, of course, with regard to the veto, there have been several overrides in that regard, more this time than the past 2 years than there have in other years, but there have also been more vetoes. And you do, of course, have a legislature that's Democrat and a governor that's Republican. I think there's one other thing that John Havelock mentioned that I'd like to expand on just slightly, and that is the relationship between the governor and other governments, the federal government. And I think our strong executive concept in the Alaska Constitution has given the state of Alaska a power with regard to the national government that we would not have had if we had a weak executive concept. When you consider that other states have to go back there to Washington in have the governor possibly say one thing, the attorney general another, the commissioner of education a third, there isn't a unified position. So in Alaska, on such things as a 200-mile limit, the law of the sea, the commission, outer continental shelf, the gas pipeline, land claims, the joint federal state land use planning commission, I think all are examples of the results of those and what has happened of the strong executive concept. And I think we've had a voice there that we wouldn't have had if we had a different concept. With regard to some of the comments that have been made, I think John Hellenthal first mentioned it with regard to Lieutenant Governor. One of the things that we see from the legislative point of view is the result of the present system is, I think, to place the Lieutenant Governor in a very embarrassing position. He really becomes somewhat neutered by the way in which it's done. There's a certain jockeying for position within the administration after every new governor comes in. And I think the first casualty in that process is usually the lieutenant governor. Everybody sort of looks around at everybody else and wonders how much authority they have compared to anybody else. And I think all of the commissioners decide that the person that has the least authority is the lieutenant governor. They tend to gang up on him and dispose of him first and then go to work on the others. And I think that is unfortunate because you have then the possible successor that goes from because of the way it happens, to some extent almost ridicule, that if he becomes governor, the strongest position, and it's quite a transition to make in a short period of time. With regard to the confirmation hearings, I think that what John Havelock said was certainly true up until a couple of years ago. I don't think that was a power that the legislature had used as it was intended. I think it was a real weakness from the legislative point of view. But just as in other areas, I think the result of the strong executive concept has been that the legislature has had to really get its act together. And I think that transition is taking place. The legislature is asserting its prerogative, some of the time asserting prerogative that it doesn't have, but that one of the things that it has been doing is trying to use the full range of the powers that it should have been using all along. Confirmation is certainly one of them. With regard to Andy's comments that the governor was losing some of his authority, I don't think the governor has lost much of his authority to the legislature. I do think he failed recently to use some of the authority that's been there. But there's one conflict between the legislature and the executive that didn't take place, and I think it may somewhat typify some of the problems that exist at the present time. With regard to the bond bills, there isn't a fight between the legislature and the executive. The fight is actually between the executive and some other branch of the executive, because the governor attempted to veto a portion of the firefighting and the university bond bills, asked the legislature to sue him because he wasn't sure he had the authority. The legislature declined, and then the governor wound up suing himself. So I don't know how you're going to say who won that case when it's finally resolved, but it won't be the legislature because we're not a party to it. I think for the most part that concludes my remarks at this point, but the major point I wanted to make is that I think there have been some ramifications of a strong executive concept that were not particularly intended, and that while they may be desirable and certainly should not be changed by constitutional amendment, they have caused some impact in some other areas. And one of the more significant impacts has been on the legislative branch, and it's really been to force the legislative branch to act in a much more responsible manner. That's to some extent a part of a national trend that's taking place. I think there's been a resurgence of both state government and particularly state legislature. But I think nowhere is it more obvious than it's been in the state of Alaska. And one of the great emphases for that revitalization has been the strong executive concept of the Alaska Constitution.
Thanks a lot, John. John Borbridge, in bringing respect to the bear, the one who's been watching very closely much of what's going on over the years, and as a leader, as you all know, prominent leader of the Native community for several years. John?
Yeah, thank you. Always become curious as an opportunity such as this presents itself as to just how an assessment is to be made, and one reasonably goes back to expectations as they were present during the development of the Constitution and the passage of statehood itself. And certainly, as we are all very much aware, not only was the Constitutional Convention in effect a deliberation with high purpose, and also not without its share of emotional high tides in response to expectations, but much of the struggle for statehood was couched in similar terms. Thus, I became curious enough to wonder what were the expectations we have, because I think as we assess the expectations of statehood, it logically leads to whether or not we have been able to achieve those expectations, and whether or not the form of government we had, characterized as has been very well described and analyzed today, the strong executive form of government, which perhaps has been advanced to us, is one of the strongest in any of the states in the Union. And as all of us recall, the arguments advanced by Alaskans to further the cause of statehood included the basic desire to achieve the right of self-determination and the right to exercise the prerogatives of choice within the context of Alaskan needs, Alaskan goals, and Alaskan desires. And in effect, very simply, democracy. And as you recall, we had gone through a period of time when we had experienced earlier neglect from the federal government, followed by the heavy hand of the federal government, colonialism, if you will, along with very deliberate and in most instances ignorant interference with the imposition of either incomplete or inappropriate laws to Alaska. In developing a listing of why Alaska needs statehood, I thought it was enough interest to see what the Alaska Statehood Committee itself had listed. And in its report, dated 1953, the committee advanced some of the following. And I think it is fascinating to examine them in the light of where we are or appear to be and where we appear to be going or hope to be going. It is contended that we needed statehood because, first, we had no control over public lands. I think right now all of us could spend the rest of this period. Could we not, Chuck Herbert, on talking about that? Another point, Alaska has no control over its resources, the fisheries, timber, wildlife, coal, oil, minerals, water power. And again, we may ask, where have we gone and how much progress has been made? How carefully have we delineated where we want to go with respect to these items? Alaska can only govern itself insofar as Congress permits it. Again, we have the specific references made earlier today to some of the congressional impact on the future of the state of Alaska. We had further faces 1,700 years of waiting for its lands to be surveyed if the federal government continues surveying at the same speed as the past 80 years. I think that's been reduced to 1,000 years. And so that here again are some of the items, the very specific items that were advanced to Alaskans at that time as a means for persuading not only Alaskans but non-Alaskans that statehood should be supported. And yet as we look today, many of the items that face us are very familiar and have reference to these specific items that were advanced very analytically and very carefully by the Alaska Statehood Committee 23 years ago. The D2 issue with the planning for and the expectation as to what will be done with 80-plus million acres of land. We have the disposition still to be made of possibly some of the oil that will be shipped through the Alaska pipeline, with an obvious impact known and perhaps to some degree unknown on the revenue expectations of the state. Outer Continental Shelf development with its impact on the communities in Alaska. Whatever we may consider will be happening to PETFOR and whatever kind of influence we will have, that certainly will be an important factor. The gas pipeline, the development of policy and where we are going to go with respect to the development and the exploration, for that matter, of mineral resources, what will be happening to the timber and what the policy of the state will be. And again, all of these lead directly to where and what a strong executive is going to do. Fisheries, the 200-mile limit, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, all of these are perhaps having a greater impact on us and exerting greater pressure and demanding a sense of greater and stronger leadership than perhaps even those items that faced us before we became a state. Now, clearly, I have a sense of optimism because I think that some of the inequities have been corrected, but still, many of the same basic problems remain. And the development of the state's constitution and the subsequent achievement of statehood has really created the catalyst and it has set the stage. But the circumstances creating or perpetuating those problems, both factual and attitudinal, persist. And the circumstances in which we function and in which our state persists is dynamic in a state of flux. The battle for statehood, I submit, was not only a battle to achieve statehood, but the battle for statehood is just as alive, just as dynamic, and just as much of a challenge as is being faced by us today. I almost feel like saying sometimes that I'm not so sure that we ought to disband a committee for statehood, but rather its perspective would simply change a little bit. But I also submit to you that, in my opinion as one individual, the document, the means of meeting these challenges, has been put squarely in our hands. We have the type of executive that needs to be strong, although in my opinion, I don't think any of the governors actually have been as strong as the power that has been available to them. But again, I think perhaps this was in large part a recognition of the political system, which doesn't immediately encourage the acquisition and utilization of power as though there were not. It might, in effect, be counterproductive if not carefully done. It's interesting to note, in looking at the governor's management and the efficiency review, Governor Hammond's, that we're reminded that in 17 years of statehood, Alaska has, and I quote, rapidly growing demands for government services, as well as substantial increases in the cost of providing those services. Government expenditures were approximately $350 million in fiscal 1972. And for fiscal 1976, expenditures were expected to equal around $600 million. And this was an 82% increase in 4 years, and it's expected that perhaps the 1977 budget will expand to the vicinity of $700 million, which would not include the proposed general obligation bonds, capital expenditures of $239 million. So that clearly the accelerated growth of management of the state, namely the growth of government, is one of the items that is going to have as much of an impact on the quality of living lifestyle, if you will, as any one factor. Now, from a crisis occasioned in the past by a time where Alaska did not have enough money, we appear to be moving to, I would submit to you, a crisis of affluence. A crisis of affluence simply because we expect we are going to have enough to meet all of our needs. And that it's logical to assume that with the anticipated revenues that we expect from the oil, the flow of oil, that citizen expectations are going to be rising again. And I submit again that here it is extremely important that we not only have a leadership in terms of the executive as to substance, because as I see our delegate to our right, I would say that the Constitutional Convention gave us that substance and they gave us the means of meeting these challenges. But it becomes perhaps a matter of style and a matter of vision, a matter of dedication. We seem to be moving, if we are not careful, toward a dependence and then overdependence perhaps on one industry, oil, and just how the strong executive can have the impact on the rising expectations of the electorate is something that remains to be seen, but certainly it is there. It is something that we will want to concern ourselves with. There's also been concern about input by the electorate into the decision-making process. And here we have had, and I feel that we have needed and continue to need, a strong executive, the governor. And yet there is no question that with the growth of and the actual utilization of the powers effective and available to the executive, there is concern about the input by the citizenry into the decision-making process. Logically, this would be expected as the citizens go to the polls and elect their representatives to represent them, as well as when they go to the polls and elect their governor. But still, there is a feeling among the citizenry that having helped to establish who shall serve both in the legislative and executive branches, they still need the further assurance that somehow they will be heard in another dimension, if you will, by having a direct impact as measurable in terms of executive branch response to them or legislative response to the electorate itself. I think some efforts are currently being made with the development of the Alaska Public Forum as an outgrowth and development by the Alaska Growth Policy Council. And again, there's another balance, if you will, that seems to require a very careful approach here. It's viewed in some quarters that reference to the electorate and having involvement of the people in the decision-making process represents something of an abdication of executive power and perhaps represents a sense of passing the buck. I think here there is a balance that clearly needs to be achieved. I think it is possible. Certainly the development of task forces as used in past administrations, Rural Affairs Commission, and other means have been used to try to supplement the sense of representative democracy, in effect offering the opportunity directly to people to have input into government and to have that sense of involvement. These things are important, and as we look at one of the further developments, I realize that in having the opportunity, privilege in my opinion, to present some views just as an individual, perhaps the first thing I would have to comment is, as a native individual, if there's one thing that strikes me, it is the lack of a monolithic opinion as to where the natives stand or what the natives think, because I have never been able to determine that. But still, I think there are some things certainly that the native people agree on. As we look at the passage of the Native Claims Settlement Act, I hope that you'll be able to share with me the coincidence in which the native people, as they deal with the expectations that they have, are faced with many of the same challenges and many of the same requirements that state government itself is facing. For example, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act formed, or caused to be formed, corporations. The corporations of necessity chose to become, or in the case of regional corporations, were mandated to become profit-making corporations. And yet, in fact, the appeal made by the proponents of the Claims Settlement Act was based on a matter of a national conscience. And as these corporations are begun, they are begun as well with a sense of a people orientation. And they start with a social conscience. They do have a justification for existing in their communities. And they still must achieve a balance again between the bottom line and the human needs that they represent. And looking at the state of Alaska, it again finds itself in a similar situation, in that as it looks at the utilization of the permanent fund, as it looks at the views of the people who will be presenting, if we come to this point, plans as to how the fund might be used, again, I think it's extremely important that here we have the strong executive hand which will give us the overview that will point out that there are needs in the state yet unmet, and that to me it's almost incongruous that with the wealth that we expect, we can still go into rural Alaska and find problems pertaining to health, substandard housing. And it's almost unbelievable that we face situations where communities actually do not have access to drinking water that is pure enough to assure continued good health. And so that there will be opportunities in the business sense that I think are absolutely necessary to the future well-being of the state in terms of utilization of some of the funds that we can anticipate receiving from the oil, flow of oil. But again, the human needs have to be balanced as by the state as they must be in the native corporations. Taking a look very quickly at long-range planning, again, the native corporations face the same needs. They must ask themselves not only what do they want to be in 1991 when the restrictions on alienation of stock are removed, but they must ask themselves beyond this period of time what they want to be as they relate to the state, to their regions, to the business and economic communities. If there is one area of a vital need in the state that generally tends to be somewhat ignored, I would have to submit that it would be the matter of long-range planning. It's all too characteristic in corporations working for a business profit that the executive with the vision who incorporates long-range planning and who in effect takes the first steps in that direction very often is not around when the benefits begin to be realized. And I think this is true of any governor who takes a similar step, that when a governor in effect does place the emphasis, I consider the necessary emphasis on long-range planning, we can pretty well count on the fact that he too is not going to be around when the actual benefits are realized. It's maybe only in retrospect we'll appreciate what in effect has been done. Unfortunately, I think very often the public isn't that interested either. We're more interested in the immediate meeting of needs that we have expressed, and it's very difficult for us to take the long-range viewpoint, and again, the executive will have to do this. In effect, we view the governor as the goal setter for the state, if you will, the goal setter in any number of respects. In conclusion, I feel that the strong executive has worked, is necessary, and that the Constitutional Convention gave us the kind of executive we needed. They exercised the vision and foresaw the kind of problems we would have to deal with. As I indicated before, in large part, the governor has more power than he has exercised. I think perhaps I have to view that in the context of the political environment, they undoubtedly have made choices that have been based on their particular knowledge. The strong executive, as I've indicated, has focused by necessity, because the electorate largely demands it, on short and long-range politically sensitive issues to the general detriment of long-range considerations and planning. I think in large part they have all made efforts in this particular area, and I think frankly it is a matter of whether or not the electorate is going to have enough backbone to say, we demand this, we approve of it, we want to know more about what you are doing here. Section 26 boards, having had the opportunity to serve on the State Board of Education, the actual working or functioning, it appears to me, depends pretty much on the style of the chief executive of the time and the relationship with the board. And in my period of time, I found that I used to keep the board